Welcome to Free Speech Bites. I'm Kirsty Hughes, Chief Executive at Index on Censorship. Free Speech Bites is our podcast series made in association with Sage. In this series, Nigel Warburton interviews a number of leading figures about free expression and why it matters.
Dennis McShane is a Labour MP with a keen interest in human rights. I asked him to choose a free speech icon, someone whose life highlights the importance of free expression. Dennis McShane, welcome to Free Speech Bites.
Great to be with you. Great to be doing anything with Index on Censorship.
Now, who is your free speech icon?
I've got many, mainly great journalists and writers, Voltaire perhaps, but I want to focus on Thomas Paine because he was the original Euro-Atlanticist. He straddled both America and France and, of course, his own country, is a Thetford lad, England. He's born in the middle of the 18th century. It's always important, I think, when you want to be involved in great world events, to be of the right age. So as a young man, he floats off to America to make his way, to perhaps find his fortune, but he finds himself deep in the American Revolutionary movement. And clearly he's just a wonderful born agitator and writer. One thinks in these days maybe of somebody like Michael Foote as a politician or Christopher Hitchens as a writer and journalist and engaged political activist. And Paine was there and he just had the gift of looking for words and finding them and putting them into marvellous shape and sense. And so undoubtedly his great pamphlet Common Sense was one of the contributing books, start books of the American Revolution, explaining why what they were doing made sense. And the art of successful political transformation is not to call people to go and die on the barricades or to climb Mount Everest without oxygen. It's just to say what you're doing makes sense and strip away the veils of, not so much lies, but just the veils of belief that stop something happening and being done. And that's what Thomas Paine did. He showed by taking on the British establishment, taking on the British state, taking on the equivalents of the Rupert Murdochs and David Camerons of the day, that powerful words could move mountains and help give birth to the United States of America. To be close to one great social change in a person's lifetime, and I was involved with South African trade unions getting rid of apartheid, solidarity in Poland, I was put in prison by the communists, helping to dismantle the Soviet bloc. That's terrific, but this guy's at the heart of the American Revolution, and then he's at the heart of the French Revolution, and I doubt there's been an Englishman in the entire history of the English race, whatever that means, who has been so central to such monumental historic change and contributing to it, not just a witness, but actually writing the words that help take that change forward.
Unlike many radicals today in England, he was at severe risk for his life because of what he was writing.
Very much so. I mean, they didn't like him in England. He goes to France, and there's a big political battle over the nature of the French Revolution. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive and to be young was very heaven, wrote the young William Wordsworth as he looked at this epochal change in Europe, the king being deposed and a republic being created. But then along comes a crusty old conservative. They're always there. You can't keep them in the woodwork. They come shooting out. Edmund Burke, brilliant writer, a great, great parliamentarian, and he writes Reflections on the French Revolution, which is a huge dump on it. It's like reading all your worst articles about immigrants or Europe in the Daily Mail, or the Telegraph, or the Sun. Some powerful arguments. The French Revolution did take a very sad, bad turn when it started chopping off lots of people's head and introduced the terror and produced the first justification of what we later call terrorism. But in the initial period, there is Paine writing from France explaining why this was a good thing, that kings should quake on their thrones, that men and women didn't need to live under the subjection of an aristocracy or a monarch and could form their own governments. And the British hated him for him. Straight away, of course, he fell foul of our wonderful libel laws. He is sued for seditious libel and sentenced to huge terms of imprisonment in absentia, because he's in France and he wasn't coming back for the pleasure of my learned friends and the judges and all the rest of it, who wanted to lock him up for years and throw away the keys. And then he writes the Rights of Man, probably his greatest book, extraordinary book again in English, because he's in France. He's even elected to the National Assembly without speaking a word of French, which is extraordinary. But that was the puissance of Paine's name. And then, of course, he falls foul of the French, because whatever happens, revolutions devour their children. And almost anybody who stands up for freedom of expression, whether it's Galileo, whether it's Spinoza, whether it's Voltaire, or in modern times in China, in Wang Qimei, Liu Xiaobo, whether it's in Africa, any tyrannical disposition, or even a state which doesn't recognise the importance of letting free thought flourish, you always end up falling foul of your own friends. So it's touch and go with Robespierre, whether he goes first or he gets Tom Paine's head chopped off first. So quite sensibly, Tom Scarpa's for America, where he then upsets everybody by doing a Richard Dawkins or a Christopher Hitchens by saying, God doesn't exist. Oh boy. I mean, how many enemies do you want to make in one lifetime? And there is Paine writing pamphlets and books saying you can organise society more fairly, there should be a guaranteed living wage or minimum income for everybody in society. It's quite possible to do it if you have more equality. You don't have to take orders from priests, from established religions, from Christianity. In those days, it would be different Christian religions or Islam, or I suppose for some Jewish people, Judaism today. They're there, of course, but they shouldn't control our lives. I mean, in a sense, he was the original, one of the early Christianophobes, if that's the right word. Directly, I think, you can draw a line between him and Christopher Hitchens' last great book for his autobiography, and then falling ill and dying, sadly. And of course, Christopher, who's one of my dearest friends from university days, and we did a lot of journalism and activism together, Christopher himself wrote a marvellous book on Tom Paine. And it's a shame in these rather managerial days, when politics is all about minor adjustments, that there aren't people actually ready to think big picture stuff. And whatever you say about Tom Paine, he was Mr. Big Picture.
What do you think was driving him?
I think it's just that desire to write. You see it a bit later on with Shelley and Byron, both themselves having to leave Britain, just uncertain whether their descriptions of the truly awful repression after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, after the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, culminating in Peterloo, and ghastly repressive measures against freedom to speak, freedom of organisation, that it's better to be out of the country. I mean, the MPs who signed the death warrant for Charles the First, a sensible one, scarpered to Switzerland and saw out their days there. The idiot stayed at home saying, well, he's dead now, and you know, it didn't quite work. Now we've got a restoration, we'll be left in peace. They were left in peace, pieces of their head stuck on spikes on the bridges over the Thames. But nonetheless, if you have that impulse to speak out, look at Liu Xiaobo. He is a Chinese human rights activist, pro-democracy campaigner, pamphleteer, was awarded the Nobel Prize last year, and is still in the Chinese gulag. One would think a nation would honour somebody who won the Nobel Peace Prize, but the Chinese cannot accept that people should speak their mind in their own country. And very sadly, despite huge efforts, I've never been able to get David Cameron or William Hague to pronounce Liu Xiaobo's name, either at the dispatch box of the Commons or in any public expression face-to-face with the Chinese. And it's a horribly shaming aspect of this present government. Unlike, one was reluctant to cite a name, but Margaret Thatcher was ready to mention Andrei Sakharov's name and support freedom under the Soviet communist regime, but David Cameron and William Hague are so pusillanimous that they will not support freedom of expression as it's repressed under the Chinese communist regime.
Since you've raised this issue of freedom of speech in relation to politics, where do you think the limits should lie? Because clearly it can't be right that anything goes.
Quite so. I was taking part in the Defamation Bill Standing Committee. This is the bill that's been through the House of Commons and now will go to the House of Lords, then come back to the House of Commons. It's quite a good bill. It reflects certainly a very effective campaign by a lot of people, and I pay tribute particularly to Evan Harris and to Index on Censorship that provided a lot of the impulse for this. And it tidies up a lot of the bad anomalies in our libel system, particularly so-called libel tourism, the right of proper scientific investigation and journalistic commentary on scientific aspects, pharmaceutical, chemical and other things, if properly quoted, to be protected from powerful companies that want to shut you up. But that said, there's a nagging doubt in my mind that it still protects the guys with money. It still, for example, brings in a defence that says serious harm must be done. Now, that's an interesting definition. It hands all the power to a judge. You're abolishing jury trials. And serious harm is in the eyes of which beholder. There can be a lot of local cases where one needs a swift and speedy retraction or correction by local media, which doesn't damage the paper. It's embarrassing, and maybe they won't do it again. It's not about big expenses, these huge figures that used to be mentioned. And I worry that we still haven't got that quite right. It's also linked in, obviously, with Lord Justice Leveson's inquiry. And getting that line right is very, very tricky. I tend to be more down the American road of absolute freedom of speech as guaranteed by the First Amendment to their Constitution. That said, United States mass media, say the newspapers that are widely read or their television, actually is much more professional and cautious than our mass media, because our sensationalist tabloids will just tell open lies about people in order to get a good headline or to sensationalise a story. That's about the ethical practices of journalism, which again is quite tricky. But I think on the whole, you know, we always err on the side of publication. I'm old enough to remember when you couldn't read Lady Chatterley's Lover. That was a crime. When you had censorship of theatre plays, when the BBC was the only broadcast channel and very, very staid. But on the other side of the equation, I go a lot to East Europe, to Caucasian countries, Balkan countries, where you see newspapers that are just virulently dishonest about their opponents and are used simply as political weapons to destroy individuals. So the debate isn't around themes or policies or ideas. It's not balance. It's just a huge dump, and that, I think, damages the notion of free speech. We've eliminated, I think, the notion you have complete free speech on racism or anti-Semitism. Promote paedophilia. 40 years ago, it would have been illegal, I think, to, say, have discussed gay relationships openly. We moved on. It's a constant dialectic, and certainly, I mean, I don't hold with the idea that there's absolute free speech for any racist or any extremist to propagate his ideas. I mean, I track a lot of work on anti-Semitism, and some of the language used by Jews, sadly, by ultra-Salafist jihadi Islamists, not remotely by the vast bulk of the Muslim population or Muslim intellectuals and writers, is truly horrific and needs to be very, very firmly stamped down, because no one should live in their own country just a little bit frightened because they were born Jewish or born Muslim or born black. And anything that creates an atmosphere of fear, I think, can't easily go through the sieve of absolute free speech. And a related difficulty is, in the old days, that would be written in green ink and sent to two or three people. Now, social media, the net, Twitter. I mean, I've received credible death threats because of work I've done, traced back to AOL addresses somewhere in Essex. And by the time the cops find them, you run out of steam. But it's quite frightening just how the social media can propagate truly evil attacks on people's integrity. But Google and the other internet providers all throw up their hands and say, oh, we're only doing free speech. No, sorry, gentlemen. There are some limits.
In some people's eyes, amongst his contemporaries, Thomas Paine might have seemed an extremist. This is somebody who is challenging the throne. I mean, he's challenging the notion of the power of a monarch. And that would have been as shocking, perhaps, as certain kinds of racism are to us.
I think there's a difference between saying we can live differently, which is what Thomas Paine was arguing, and we don't need to accept blind authority from God or a king, and saying that black people should remain slaves in the United States forever. I'm not quite sure what his position was on that. And George Washington, of course, as we know, kept slaves at his farm and lands just down on the Potomac outside Washington at Mount Vernon. So, to some extent, you have to locate everybody in his time. Voltaire, who gave us the famous defence of free speech, if he actually said it, I may disagree with what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it, which even if he didn't say it, si non è vero, bene trovato, is a wonderful aphorism. But the guy was a roaring anti-Semite. So I'm afraid nobody is perfect. People are located in their time and place. And if I read everything Paine wrote and found racist comments, then I think those should be condemned. But in the end, he's known and remembered and was read not for that, but for challenging authority. And you must never, ever stop challenging authority. As Shelley said, freedom's flag flies against the wind. It always has to, you have to go against the current, against the conventional thinking. You may get a lot of things wrong, but if you look at Paine, the reason he's still remembered today is he got so much right.
For more information about Index on Censorship, go to www.indexoncensorship.org.